You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 17th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. I almost wore a t-shirt today, but instead I went with my classic soft-collared, sporty, not-quite-polo shirt. Kelly wants to comment on my sartorial decision. What is it?
Sartorial. It's your best shirt.
Oh, well, thank you, Kelly. Yeah. It's actually new. You didn't notice that, but it's the exact same shirt that I always wear, but I bought a new one.
Are you being serious?
Yeah, and they actually make them thinner now. This thing's going to wear out even sooner.
You know what that also means?
It's not just that I'm wearing this shirt, ladies and gentlemen. Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Also on the program, ostensibly to give me a movie review, Matthew Film Guy. Meanwhile, fallout continues. The mass shooting in Florida. People still digging through, investigating now. Omar Mateen's wife trying to piece together the motivation behind this mass killing. But we do know the means, ladies and gentlemen. That quite obvious. Meanwhile, Paul Ryan hedges and G.W. Bush mobilizes to save GOP senators. Ladies and gentlemen, when you're asking for G.W.'s help, you know you've got a problem. Meanwhile, that British MP apparently killed in a political assassination by a reportedly mentally disturbed neo-Nazi. Last night, Bernie Sanders giving a, not sure how to characterize that address to supporters, but his game plan revealed, partially a question mark, partially a statement. And new polling suggests that normal people still hate Donald Trump. Study shows the parenting happiness gap is real, and it's worse in America. But it could be fixed. And Iraqi forces retake a Fallujah center, pushing off ISIS, while 51 former diplomats send a letter. I don't know who they sent it to. Just to, I guess, all of us, that we should strike Syria and Assad, presumably because the bombing will lead to peace. I don't know. It doesn't seem to work out that way. I don't know what the backup, I don't know what phase two of that is. Phase two seems to be drop bombs and then problem solved. It goes into a box. You drop the bomb, then there's a box, and something happens in that box, and then peace comes out the other side. I don't know. This has been a horrible situation now for, feels like five years now, and I'm not quite clear that there's anything that the United States can do. But there, those diplomats are quite convinced that we should bomb, and who knows, maybe, you know, I don't know what, I have no sense of what Clinton or Trump would do in this situation. My guess is that certainly not off the table, military intervention. Certainly not off the table with either one of them, frankly. But that's where we're at. Last night I was on MSNBC during Bernie's speech. It was a little bit awkward, I have to say, because I presumed that we were going to watch the whole speech. And it didn't work out that way. You know, like I don't necessarily get a lot of, I don't get the full game plan when I go on there. And I don't know if they even knew the full game plan, frankly. I don't think that they got the speech until later. Usually these things are embargoed. You get them an hour earlier, you can tell like what the timing is. It didn't appear that they had. It seemed like it was released last minute. And I was asked to give my reaction to the speech three quarters of the way through it, which was, I think it was one of those things where they had anticipated the speech being shorter. I'm not sure exactly. And I had a limited reaction because I had a limited look at the speech. But following the segment, I went and I watched the rest of it on YouTube on the way home. And it occurred to me that, you know, there was obviously some disappointment, I guess, that Bernie Sanders was not conceding. And there was, I noticed multiple journalists and pundits and the like tweeting out, if Bernie Sanders waits any longer, he's going to lose his leverage for concessions. And it occurred to me, particularly in the context of the story about Donald Trump yesterday in the Vanity Fair, and I had heard and I had had a conversation with somebody who had sort of verified that there's at least talk in that camp about a Trump media, that if Donald Trump is actually thinking, okay, I'm not going to win this race, what he's going to do is he's going to focus on building that media enterprise. And one of the ways you do that is to edify your base, your people, right? And it's quite possible that Bernie Sanders' calculation at this point is, well, I'll get into this with Cliff, but this notion of his leverage will be diminished. I'm not sure at this point what his leverage would get him in any context. Even at the height of his leverage, I'm not sure what it would have gotten from Clinton beyond what they have gotten at this point, which is a legitimate platform battle. And I just wanted to tee that up so that I didn't have to say that to Cliff. And so do you have a notion of where I'm coming from when we have this conversation with Cliff? Now, of course, we're also going to be talking about the filibuster with Cliff because of his, his expertise in this area in terms of fighting for gun reform. But let's take a quick break. I wanted to also, gosh, I forgot about this. Remind you, A, that on Ring of Fire this weekend, Bobby Kennedy has been working on the Porter Ranch case. He comes on to the show and we talk about that and these bomb trains. Bobby and I talked, I think, for about an hour on the program. Also on Ring of Fire, Wendell Potter, Adam Green, John Nichols. Various topics that we talk about, but you can check it out at ROF. You can sign up for the free podcast at rofpodcast.com. Also, you are aware that today is June 17th and that June 19th is 2 days away and June 19th is Father's Day. Now, I know a bunch of you, I'm looking at you, Michael, I'm suspecting even you, Kelly, Matt
Stealth.
Yeah, Matt's just hiding in the corner. But I have a feeling that all three of you did not give your father a Father's Day gift. What, you did or you didn't?
I sent him a card like he wants.
Oh, God.
No, he likes it, Sam.
You know what, Kelly? I speaking as a father, I say that to my kids all the time, and I never mean it. I'm always waiting for that day.
I think there might be a little bit of an age difference.
Yes, for that's right. And as my kids get older, my daughter gets older, Kelly, my expectations rise a little bit. And so I always say, oh, I just want a card. But deep down, what I really want is a gift, a legitimate gift. So, Kelly, even though you miss Father's Day, you can still send your dad a Father's Day gift. It'll show up a little bit late, but you know what? Dads don't care about that kind of thing. And a Harry's shaving set will make the perfect late Father's Day gift. It looks cool, it feels special, and it's something that your father will actually use. Not a card, which he's going to go and he's going to take it, he'll put it in a desk drawer, he won't see it again for years. Yeah, he hangs it up just when you come home. That's true. Believe me, I know. Look, this limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand, Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, three of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, a travel cover, all for $40. Plus, it comes in a sleek, giftable box with the option to add custom engraving and a personalized card. How do I know this? Because I think on this very day today, my dad is getting his. I think it's showing up at his house today.
I think you're right. I think he would enjoy Harry's razor.
Of course he would. Harry's also offers shaving sets at different price points, starting at $15. Get one for yourself. It's a great shave at a fair price. Easy to order. Order online. You don't have to go to the store to pick out a gift. So in other words, you can be lazy and get credit for being thoughtful. Go to harrys.com right now. Redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MajorityReport. Don't wait. Economy shipping for Father's Day ended, well, it ended about a week ago. Sorry about that. That's harrys.com. Enter code MajorityReport at checkout for $5 off. Get Dad something he'll actually use a couple of days after Father's Day. Nobody's perfect. Your dad doesn't expect you to be perfect. But do get him a gift. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Casual Friday. Yes, it's soft collar shirt Zuma's day for me, but it also means I get to listen to this little ditty.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. ShackTalkLibertasLLC.com.
Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing all right. There's such insanity in the world right now. It is, I'm starting to feel like I'm a little bit numb to it these days, ranging from the horrible deaths of 49 people and then our presidential election, all of it has seemed sort of crazy to me. But
what happened in England is
yes.
heartbreaking too. I mean, same disease that I think is what's going on here. I mean, I don't know what the proof is yet, but it sounds like this PM was assassinated basically because she believed in the European Union.
Right.
It's and they've got their Trump type people over there, you know, Britain first kind of thing. It's there's a lot of ugliness out there right now.
Yeah, the reports I have seen suggest that this guy actually was part of a sort of like a national or an international sort of like neo-Nazi organization coming out of the States, or at the very least, I mean, I don't know how involved he was, but there's records of this guy, connecting with this group and buying a kit on learning how to make a homemade gun.
Yep.
I mean, just...
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, a couple of lessons there. I would say that I don't know what the reports are right now. You know, they were saying at the time it looked like some sort of old self-made or antique kind of gun.
Right.
And so this is never to argue, as every gun nut will throw at me when I talk about laws in the United States, that there's never any shootings in England. But I would point out that this is somebody who had to make their own gun, couldn't spray a room filled with 50 people or 100 people, more like it, with a weapon of war. Doesn't really matter. And then she was murdered, and that's terrible. But it also is a reminder of how contagious the neo-Nazism and the kind of crap that Trump is shoveling is, not just in the United States, but around the world, particularly in Western Europe. You know, when you're talking about this kind of thing, it may have been an American group, you know, connected in all this. Just a reminder, when people want to jump and say, as you watch these, the nuts on the right claim that it's all, you know, quote unquote, Islamic radicals. No, I mean, in our home countries, you know what? It's still pretty much those of the domestic variety who are going around and doing these kinds of things. Not to say that either is better and both are insane and motivated by right-wing hatred and religion and a variety of other toxic things, but I mean, just we're in a dangerous period of time right now.
Yeah, and you know, just to touch on, and I want to talk about the filibuster and sort of the implications of at least some movement. I'm not necessarily excited about all of the movement, but we can talk about that. But you know, what's clear is that this was, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to sort of measure these things, but this was more of a mass shooting, it seems to me, than it was a terror attack. I mean, right? Because or the sense that, I mean, you know, this is a guy who clearly had some deep-seated issues and had no operational ties to any terrorist organizations, at least as far as we can tell at this point. You know, the facts may change.
It's sort of a reminder that you know, it doesn't matter whether it's an organized effort. It's that this kind of hate can be shared and spread very easily now. I mean, it was shared and been spread. It's been that way where it's been shared and spread via various forms of media for a long, long time. But now with our current, with how easy it is to share ideas, it's gotten even more dangerous, quite frankly. And, you know, also it just shows how out of date are when we want to just label things in certain ways based upon who the perpetrator is. Because, you know, often, I mean, can we say that every one of these other terrorist attacks, that there wasn't somebody if you want to call, you know, somebody who maybe is an extremist of the Muslim religion, that there's no self-loathing and anger for sexual liberation and other things. We can't say that. Can we say in other, you know, in cases where there's somebody who's a right-wing Christian or Jew or of any other religion? That, I mean, in other words, you know, just labeling something terrorism or just labeling something a hate crime or just labeling something, you know, somebody who's mentally unstable, self-loathing and the rest, I don't really think any of those in most cases singularly do it justice.
Right.
I think that we've got many things going on often in these cases. And that's what's so, you know, why this sort of rush to judgment by those who just want to say, keep all Muslims out or, you know, other stupid things like that is so unhelpful.
Well, I mean, that's the point, though, is that and I agree with you. There's no it's impossible, I think, or not impossible, but it's certainly in this situation, it's extremely difficult to parse out the different strands in terms of what motivated this guy to do what he did. Right. But from the perspective of, like, when you look at this at a policy level, right, which is
right.
Really why, I mean, aside from, people doing thought pieces, but the reason why you analyze what are the motivations and the mechanisms for something like this is to develop policies to stop or mitigate these things from happening, as to stop them from happening or mitigate the harm that these things can do, right? And so the value in assessing what it was that motivated this guy is important because and how he was able to do it are important because of that, because of attempting to fashion a policy response. And so, you know, the idea that we would focus on the fact that he was Muslim in this context, the only possible thing that we could do from a policy perspective to respond to that would be to shut down YouTube, I guess, and to stop books and to stop, a video from
right.
existing. The fact that this may have been born out of just some intense self-loathing and a mental illness that had gone untreated. You know, reports where this guy had problems as a kid,
right.
You know, suggest, okay, maybe a policy response is that there's opportunities for intervention here, or that maybe law enforcement, when they get reports of somebody who has maybe a history of violence or has multiple reports of, like, threatening people, law enforcement has to respond regardless of whether it's
it's a reminder, I think, that, well, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'll say a reminder here, I think, and I don't want to forget this because it's so important, is the and that's why there are some people filing bills right now to try to stop those who have committed sort of any sort of violent acts, for example, you know, as a misdemeanor or to try to stop them from getting guns, for example, because the truth of the matter is that somebody may have committed numerous felonies and we do stop them from buying guns, you know, in this country, or we at least have laws that are meant to stop them. But the truth is that somebody who's committed things, you know, violent attacks and has committed domestic violence and, fun stuff like that, who's, you've seen sort of violently misbehave in public, for example, that's a much better predictor that somebody's going to act violently in the future than somebody who, like, steals cars, you know, and tries to sell them or something of that nature, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. I mean, the recidivism rate when it comes to people who commit violent acts is through the roof, and yet we still have not changed our system to deal with that. You know, I'm not trying to do any minority report type stuff here. I'm not talking about, like, arresting people before they commit crimes. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that there are certain misdemeanor crimes that get pled down that make it quite clear that somebody just shouldn't have access to a gun.
And
in a sane country that cared about these kinds of things, that valued the lives of everybody over the toys of a few loud minority of the people, would say, yeah, that's what we need to do.
Well, but that's a way that you address this from a law enforcement perspective. But I want to make one thing clear. It seems quite obvious to me that the reason why the FBI didn't really follow up or close the case on this guy is because they were focused on the fact that this guy was Muslim. And so instead of them looking at this as like, this could be somebody who is a little bit off and is making violent threats. And maybe this isn't an FBI case, but maybe this is something that someone else should look into, or we should, we don't necessarily have the ability necessarily to put on his record in terms of buying a gun. But when this guy says, I'm a member of Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, okay, then because they're so oriented towards looking as to whether or not this is a terrorist, they say, well, we can dismiss this guy because there's no such thing. Nobody is a member of Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. The guy's clearly not a terrorist because a terrorist would never say that, because they couldn't be that. And so they dismiss this guy as a threat, overlooking some other very serious issues, like, this is the second time we've gotten reports he's threatening people to kill them.
Right. Well, we can make up all sorts of things. Right. I mean, I can go right now and throw a chair through a window and say I'm a Basque separatist. I read their stuff online and they inspired me. It doesn't mean it's actually true.
Well, but the problem is, if they only are judging whether or not you're a threat based upon whether or not you're a terrorist, then, of course, the system breaks down there because as far as they're concerned, he's not going to go commit a terrorist attack. Will he go and shoot up a place? Well, we didn't address that. And so my point being on all of this is that there's only one policy response to this, and that has to be to prevent someone like this from getting access to the means to kill this many people. I mean, that's
that is the obvious and easiest response that just should be. I mean, it should just be common sense. And we've talked about this before. Again, you know, this kind of thing happened in Australia, their Port Arthur massacre in 1996. They had gun laws that were more stringent than ours, but not so much so until that time. And they were a country, you know, a much smaller population, admitted, but a country founded in a similar way to this country was founded, on the frontier where people owned guns. So that sort of excuse about why we're different just doesn't hold any weight. And they decided after that, and it was the conservative government run by John Howard that just said this is untenable. You know, the guy in that killing, I think 35 people were killed, another 40 were injured. It wasn't even as bad. I mean, everything's as bad, but as Orlando. And, you know, they looked at what you should do when you're dealing with a issue of public health, which is what statistically shows that it works. And they passed a series of measures, and they were averaging one, or I think it was over one, 1.2 or 1.3 or something if you broke it down, violent, you know, mass killings a year, which for their population was a decent number. But afterwards, they have not had one since 1996. Look, an assault rifle, everybody who wants to buy one of those, you know, if we did what we make women go through who want to control their own bodies, for example, every one of these guys who wants to buy one of those should probably be forced to sit in a room and watch a video for 10 minutes of what these things do to people. The parents of Newtown said their kids were cut to pieces. I've seen these pictures of some of these victims of this thing. It is just, it's appalling. And, you know, I mean, it is a weapon of war. The person who made the AR-15 came out and said the other day that the family said that this weapon was never meant for the streets. You know, Stanley McChrystal came out the other day, right? Former head in Afghanistan said this is not a weapon for the streets. I mean, it's not like you need people like that to come out and say it is common sense that the damage this weapon does. It tears people apart, and it is not good for hunting unless you like eating your deer in little bits, and it's not good for for protecting your home unless you like shooting down your entire house when one person, which by the way statistically will never happen, but if it were to happen and one person breaks in, unless you want to take down half your house or your entire house. It is something that can spray bullets around an entire area. It is meant for mass killing. What situation does anybody run into except for committing mass homicide when they need that? You know, and that's just what it comes down to. There's just no way these weapons should be on the streets. Absolutely none. And in a sane society, they wouldn't be. There is no way, obviously, that we should still not be doing background checks on every person who wants to buy any weapon. There's no way we shouldn't be questioning who's allowed to carry guns in public and allowing in certain states people to walk around so that the police can't tell the difference until somebody decides to use that assault weapon because they're allowed to openly carry or carry a concealed weapon, even though in some states you don't even need to have any training with that weapon. This is all craziness.
Let me just read, just to reiterate your point about these guns. From a 2010 Ammo Land blog. It was a Bushmaster Firearms press release. Inspired by the overwhelming response to Bushmaster's Consider Your Man Card Reissued sweepstakes. That was their ad campaign. And they got a picture of their the Bushmaster with a with Consider Your Man Card Reissued. They also write, I'll just read the last lines of this. With additional facilities, okay. The BFI supplies aluminum advanced carbon fiber-based rifle platforms in calibers ranging from 5.56 millimeters to 223 to 50 BMGs. These and associated accessories manufactured by BFI meet the tactical rifle needs of U.S. customers as well as military law enforcement and security clients from over 50 countries worldwide. And it says at the bottom, if it's good enough for the professional, it's good enough for you. I mean, so for all you ammosexuals out there who are going to complain, send me a tweet about how you don't know what a military weapon is, an assault weapon. You just, I don't care. And so, all right, let's talk about the filibuster, where that brought us, and talk about some other ideas that are floating around. I mean, there was a piece of Market Watch from yesterday basically just saying this guy, Tim Mulaney, and, you know, I don't like these type of responses. I would love to see the law providing these gun manufacturers with immunity struck down or reversed, I should say, legislatively. Because I would love to see these people sued out of business, frankly, or just forced to make their product safer in some fashion.
Well, that's the key of the whole thing, is it would be wonderful to see them sued out of business. But what those lawsuits do, I mean, obviously, a great example is the smoking,
tobacco industry. Yep.
It's not like cigarettes don't exist now. It's not like if you're an adult, you can't go and get cigarettes and smoke. But, you know, think of secondhand smoke. Think of what that did to all sorts of people. It's similar to somebody carrying a gun around in public and putting us all in danger. You know, and the cigarette companies had to make their product safer. Is what they had to do. They had to warn people. I mean, there are all these sorts of things, or companies would go out of business. The simple fact of the matter is that a classic example would be the existence of smart gun technology.
Right.
I mean, the fact most people don't understand that right now we could end all virtually every single, like 100% of gun accidents. Or let's say the accidents with kids, pardon me, not accidents where the
toddlers
shoot themselves
right.
Because they're cleaning their gun and they're an imbecile and it's loaded. I'm talking about like kids picking up guns. We could end that tomorrow, and yet they won't do it. And the reason why is because they can't get sued. And if they could get sued for this kind of stuff, it would force them, as it's done in the automobile industry too, it forces them to move on to the safest technology that exists
of
out
course.
There, or they're found liable of just, you know, of all sorts of committing all sorts of crimes. And that's the thing, you know, not crimes, but they're hit up for financially. And that's the thing that we can't do right now.
This Market Watch thing was interesting, though. Basically, the idea was that, you know, someone like Michael Bloomberg should just buy these companies. Their market cap, I guess, on these big gun manufacturers are, you know, a billion here, a billion there. He just basically said,
"You or me, you know, we might have to borrow just a bit to get there."
Yeah, but, I mean, this guy was just basically saying, like, you know, after the Microsoft bought LinkedIn for $26 billion, basically saying, like, you could buy up the gun industry, still have like $23 billion left over to buy LinkedIn, and then just shut them down.
I think that's an interesting. The one I like really is these guys are going to have to compete in some manner, and so what I wish, even if he didn't buy up the entire industry, is someone like Bloomberg would buy up one of these companies and then put all the technology into place, do all of that, advertise it, push it out there. You know, you'd change a lot of minds, and then you'd show people how much safer their kids would be. Most people would switch over to it. Most people just don't have a choice right now, and they don't know about it. You know, and that's a really big problem. I wish someone would get a hold of one of these companies and then set up a bunch of dealerships and do that.
And I think, like, the last time I think we had this conversation, we were hoping that we would start to see reports of, like, what company's responsible, you know, that toddler who was killed this week or this day was killed by a Smith & Wesson or was killed by a Bushmaster or whatever it was. It seems to me that there's a, you know, there's a flush rush type of campaign that I don't know if it would be effective, but I imagine if the word Smith and Wesson became synonymous with toddler death, then I think, you know, that might create some pressure, some disinvestment. Maybe it wouldn't.
I would also add the fact of individuals. You know, we've seen it. A classic example is, you know, in some of the, and obviously they're not fully divesting. I think some of the reasons why the Koch brothers have moved away from politics, or at least presidential politics, obviously is Donald Trump, and he doesn't stand for what they stand for, so they don't want to support him. And they are involved in some Senate races and whatever, but a lot of the reason why they, you know, at least in one or two reports that came out, they had moved away, a lot of their money away from sort of national political races, is they didn't like the fact that people like Harry Reid and others were making them infamous. They're private people. They like being able to sit on their boards, like the National History Museum, and not have people protest that, which people effectively started to do, and be able to give money to hospitals and seem like great guys. And they have been becoming uncomfortable with the fact that they're infamous for how evil they are. And why is it that we don't have the CEOs and maybe some other people, the top at some of these gun companies? They should be infamous. They should be protested. I know some of them live happily abroad. You know, there was an article on Mother Jones about that, the Beretta family and others who are not in the United States. But they do have to come here now and again.
Right.
They do have to actually live in there. It's not like there haven't been international protests before. It's not like we couldn't have people protesting them in Italy, you know, and having people protesting in other countries. These are not such far-off places where that couldn't happen. There are international organizations like Avaaz. I'm just saying, you know, they should have to be infamous, and they should have to be forced to live an uncomfortable existence if they're going to continue to do this. I think every time one of these things happens, let's name the company and let's name who the top officials are. Get them out there.
All right. Let's just talk briefly about what happened in the Senate the other day. I mean, it's fairly encouraging on one level. You had a 15-hour filibuster. It brought about really just McConnell allowing a vote on two things. One was that if you're on the terror watch list, that you would be denied the ability to purchase a gun. And the second being, the second escapes me now.
Second is background checks.
Background checks, right. Expanding background checks.
Now, I know you and I have disagreed on the terror list, and yep. I've given you my reason before, which is I don't disagree that people need due process. And as part of Feinstein's bill there, I would want there to be the ability, it sort of has to be similar to probable cause, right? The police have probable cause. They can search your car or your home or do things, but they can't, you know, deny you the right to go to court and say, I didn't do this. And so I would have to have that be a part of it. You know, on sort of a philosophical level, I have less problem with it simply because, you know, we had after years of propaganda with conservative Justice Warren Burger saying that, you know, this is the biggest scam that's been pulled in the history of the U.S. politics, the NRA claiming the Second Amendment means anybody has a right to a gun. Even after all their propaganda and all their effort, it took five completely biased justices, a bare majority, to say it's an individual right. And so if I thought it really was an individual right, I'd have more of a problem with it. It wasn't for 200 years. It never has been considered. Every historian from the period tells you, who is worth anything, will tell you that's a ridiculous interpretation of what they meant, who knows the language of the time, and most legal scholars who aren't in the Federalist Society. So I don't think it's an individual right, and therefore I have no problem with it for that reason. I do have more of a problem with people not being able to get onto airplanes, quite frankly.
Issue is not with curtailing the license to buy a gun. The right to buy a gun. I don't have a problem with that. And what I have a problem with is the expansion of the terror list as like sort of a becoming, you know, because then you have a backdoor essentially for denying people rights based upon a process that is completely non-transparent. And is dubious in and of itself. And then, you know, so you do the guns, and then what do you do? Well, maybe you're not phones, or you're allowed to be surveilled 24 hours a day, or whatever it is. You need to wear a bracelet.
Yeah, I mean, understand that it sets a bad precedent.
It sets a very bad precedent.
With guns, because I, like any sane person, if, again, anybody who can read well-regulated militia knows that it's not an individual right that was guaranteed. But you're right, because now our law considers it that, because of that ridiculous decision, you're right. They could go on to other rights next. I would basically much, you know, I'm doing what I can. I support it right now. I would much rather that we just obviously have sane law and to the point where five justices, once Merrick Garland is on the court, right. Within a year, hopefully we'll go back to what the 200-year interpretation of that law, the honest one, was.
And we should say, look, you know, this is one of those sort of cynical political moves that is, you know, if I would love this to create pressure on Republicans for some form of gun reform and not actually have this take place, in other words. But I think it's dangerous. We're playing with fire a little bit with it.
I understand, I do get that perspective. It's also a very great defensive mechanism. And again, this is politics also, and not necessarily policy, against the Donald Trump type attacks and the ones that are going to come from, I see it already here, from your Rob Portmans and your Kelly Ayotte and people like that, which is, well, you want terrorists to have guns and to hit them back in a really hard way. So yes, on a political perspective, I like it for that reason too, because it defends us against the kind of stuff we saw Bush do in 2002 and 2004.
People forget that. People forget what happened to guys like Max Cleland and...
That's right. We lost so many seats because of that. I would much
and
rather.
And just sort of the disgusting thing of saying to a guy who's lost three of his limbs in war that he's basically Osama bin Laden was
right.
But all right.
And the guy running against him, it did it. Of course, Saxby Chambliss. The context of that is Max Cleland lost those limbs by fighting in Vietnam, while Saxby Chambliss claimed he had a bad knee and didn't go and serve. That's
right.
What made it even more sickening.
Well, all right. So I want to transition a little bit because we don't have too much time, but I want to talk about Bernie Sanders' speech last night. I got three clips of it, and one is, let's play two. All right, let's play this. We're going to just play one right now, and then we'll play the others later. But there was basically three sections to his speech. One was talking about, sort of broadly speaking about the success that he had, but he talked about the success and it coming in some respects as a function of some very dramatic problems that we have in this country that seem to be ignored, but largely speaking from a policy standpoint. He then pivoted to say that the campaign is not just about addressing those concerns. The campaign is also about defeating Donald Trump. And then the third part was, and he's saying, but the campaign goes beyond the presidential election, that the campaign's also about this political revolution in our country, and then began to encourage people to run for office. Let's just play a clip from the second segment of this, and that is Sanders explaining why the campaign is more than about defeating Trump. This is number two.
The major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly. And I personally intend to begin my role in that process in a very short period of time. But defeating Donald Trump cannot be our only goal. We must continue our grassroots effort to create the America that we know we can become. And we must take that energy into the Democratic National Convention on July 25th in Philadelphia, where we will have more than 1,900 delegates.
Okay, so here he is. He is basically, he's not offering an endorsement yet. It is an implicit, I think a very clear, but implicit concession. The race is over. He's quite clear on that. But yet the campaign continues. And give me your sense of this, because I have a very specific reaction to all of this. And I think what's happening is something that I don't know that we've seen, really.
Yeah. Well, this is what I wanted, frankly. So, I mean, I would prefer it, you know, I mean, I don't know if I say I would prefer it that he endorsed Hillary at this point. More important thing to me was the context of everything and making it clear for what was a great campaign and for Bernie's legions of followers to that, you know, switching over to Donald Trump, which I don't think many are going to do anyhow, but you know, every individual is an individual, that's not an option. This guy, just because he tries to sound like a populist on trade and some other things, is not acceptable. And quite frankly, the last 2 weeks, you know, where he's done everything but, you know, including, or 3 weeks, going after a judge based upon his heritage to going after an entire religion, when you know, we've got serious moments in this country, to every single thing that's come out about this guy, to all the casino workers and people that he screwed through his bankruptcies, to the emails, by the way, that he destroyed in his lawsuits, and every other just sleazy thing the guy has done, that he is not an option. And, right. I didn't expect Bernie to 100% embrace Hillary. And quite frankly, better that he doesn't, because there's still leverage that he push her in a leftward direction in a number of things. I'm fine with that. I just really want the party to come together in a basic sense and realize who it is that has to be defeated. And the thing is, last thing I'll say quickly, and I'll throw it to you, is that Trump doesn't just have to be defeated. He needs to be destroyed, because we cannot have fascism. It's fascism, pure and simple. An entire religion, you know, we can sugarcoat it all we want if we'd like to do that. But this is textbook fascism. And that needs to be, that doesn't need to just lose, 52-48. That needs to lose, 55-40 and nearly 400 electoral votes. That's what that needs to lose. It needs to be a battering. So that this doesn't raise its head in this country for a long time again.
And I would actually say, not only that, I want to see that happen to the Republican Party too. Frankly, I mean, it's not just the fascism with me. It's also,
it's the Republican Party.
It's all the other policies that would come with it.
They maybe lose the House. They maybe lose a number of state legislatures around the country that are teetering on the edge of a couple seats here and there. Means that they don't have united government anymore, and they can't destroy their population by cutting, all the things they've done, from charter schools to wages to everything else. So, this does have it's not just about Hillary Clinton as president versus Donald Trump as president, as you're saying. It has an up ballot. And I know I live in a state where it's a classic swing state, and yet the right took over our state legislature. We've got a Republican governor, and they can march in lockstep right now, taking, giving money to charter schools that have no oversight, taking away women's rights left and right, stopping wages from being raised, minimum wage, and other things that are hugely important as part of Bernie's movement. And so it's better for the people, who've gotten involved in that movement if we come together.
What's interesting to me, I think about this, and I was just saying before you came on that it's really just starting to dawn on me. I mean, here's the scenario, and this is all sort of somewhat hypothetical, but I think this is a sort of a fairly rational explanation of what we've seen. Bernie Sanders enters into this race, rationally thinking this is going to be about creating a movement that, if I was to look myself in the mirror and say, what are the likely outcomes of this? The likely outcome is not going to be that I'm going to be the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. I mean, you'd have to be a lunatic, really, frankly, to have assumed that from the beginning. And I don't think he's a lunatic. And so if he, and maybe during the course of this, at one point he said, you know what, I've got a chance to win this, which would also been a very rational response him to have. But now he's in the process where he is, now he clearly acknowledges that he's not going to win this. There are certain facts that I think are fairly clear to me that he is aware of. A, he's not going to win this. B, his continued kinetic activity, if you will, is in no way a threat to Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump. There is not a shred of evidence of it. She is up by double digits in the polls now. Donald Trump is in losing by historical margins. That may change, but today, and I think it's safe to assume over the next couple of weeks, that's not going to change. And so from his perspective, there's no opportunity cost to the goal of defeating Trump by him maintaining this. By him not endorsing Hillary Clinton, A, he could think a number of things. One, I retain more credibility with my supporters to vote against Donald Trump by not explicitly endorsing her. Or B, he may think that, like, my endorsement is sort of largely irrelevant one way or another. I've already made it clear we got to beat Donald Trump. But my continuing to sort of campaign to punch through the nomination, through the election, and actually project what I'm doing to have relevance 6 months, 8 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years out, that it makes more sense for me to coalesce my supporters. And he's taking it even further by saying, I also want to know, not only do I want to coalesce my supporters, I want to know the ones who want to get actively involved in politics. I'm not just even an activist, like actually part of an apparatus. And so from his perspective, it makes total sense, because I'm not convinced that if he would have endorsed last night, it would have increased his leverage. I mean, I think he's gotten everything that he thinks he can or everything that he wants from Clinton, that being essentially the platform battle that he was able to create,
right,
where you have, you know, five people sitting at the platform table who would have never wise, five people who would have never been represented there, views that wouldn't have been represented there. And I think that, you know, like getting rid of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I think he's probably figured out at this point, because it seems like everybody else has, that the Clinton campaign wants, they have their own people for that too, that she's gone, yep, either way. And that the process,
I don't really think at this point anybody much likes Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Right, exactly. And I think from a process standpoint, he could say open primaries, but I'm not even sure that the Clinton campaign, that the National Party can do that. This is a state by state decision anyways. And so,
right,
I think from his perspective, all this like talking about like, if he doesn't endorse now, why should she give me? I think he already went as far as he could go, as far as he thought he could go in terms of what he could get by endorsing or not endorsing or whatnot. And now what he's doing is not using the fact that he was an almost winning presidential nominee to get anything. He's now using the platform that he has built for himself and saying, I'm going to extend this further and going to use it to build a movement that is running, right, parallel to this entire electoral process.
In a way, I think it's a good thing that you can have a movement that's outside sort of independent actions, because that's everything from pushing for lower elected officials to get elected to ballot initiatives to local, you know, ordinances, whatever it might be, the way the right did with Goldwater, get people elected to the school board, you know, do all. But also it becomes a sort of almost like a parliamentary force in that, you know, it's within it, you know, a lot of the people there overlap, not everybody, with the Democratic Party in certain aspects, the progressive wing, you know, but not everybody does. And it's sort of like, I can bring these people along if you will join me on this. And so I think it's got some important implications, and I agree with you. I mean, I know people were mocking and saying, oh, tone, but tone does matter. I mean, it sends a message, you know, of who you think the enemy is and whatever, and there was everything about his tone yesterday was perfect, as far as I'm concerned. So
yeah, I mean, I personally didn't think the speech was that great, but it makes total sense to me what he's doing and this sort of outcry of, like, it is as if that there is the entire political commentariat can only understand his actions within the context of a presidential election, which nobody thought that he would win in the first place, which nobody thought was rational for him to think that he was going to win in the first place, which everybody thinks that when he entered, he probably didn't think he was going to win the first place.
Right.
So they are aware that he started with another agenda at the beginning of this campaign, but now they want him to totally throw it away, because as if this is like some type of medieval duel where, like, it's not honorable for you to continue with what you're doing now that you've been vanquished in this presidential primary. And I think his attitude is like, guys, I'm not playing your little game. I'm not involved,
right,
in that game at all. I'm playing a different game.
Now, I got to say, because you're going to kick me off soon.
Yeah.
Can you have can one of your folks there play the breaking news, you know?
Yeah, I can, buddy. I'm in charge of all that.
Oh, crap. Sorry, man. I give you the respect.
What do you got?
What I got is that Representative David Jolly has dropped out of the Republican primary for Florida Senate seat from the and is going to run for re-election. And the, what, you know what the implications of that are?
What's that? Marco Rubio is going to jump
Rubio
back in.
Marco Rubio is running, is in, clearly. I mean, it hasn't been announced, but right. I mean, if Jolly's out, Rubio's in.
So, oh, yeah.
We are going to have Marco Rubio, folks, to kick around for just a bit longer.
Yeah,
and
you know,
and just so people know, his approval rating at this point, after what Trump did to him in Florida, and after not showing up for like any votes and calling the Senate a crappy place to make change, is 32%. So don't think that he has that seat guaranteed.
I'll tell you something.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is why I want Grayson to win, but just because I know that Grayson will continue to call him Little Marco.
I'm with you. I would love to see what Grayson will.
If they, whoever the Democratic primary winner is, if they don't refer to him, if they don't at least say, I'm not Donald Trump, I'm not going to call him Little Marco. Because I think calling him Little Marco is the wrong thing to do. So I'm never going to call him Little Marco.
I will never say Little Marco.
I know that Donald...
I won't say Little Marco.
Exactly. He should just keep going. Like, I know that Donald Trump called him Little Marco, but I refer to him as just Marco.
Some people called him Little Marco. I wrote it down.
Right.
They called him Little Marco.
They called him Little Marco.
It was terrible. I felt bad for him.
No, I would love to see. I'm hoping Grayson gets a nomination just for the fun that... we'll come out of that, as well as I think we'll win. So,
yeah. Well, Cliffy, I got to do this.
No.
I had read that before the show. I'm sorry. I was going to talk about it, and
that was just mean, dude.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
Politico, you're quicker than Politico. They sent it out, you know, a thing while I'm on the show with you.
Oh yeah, no, I'd already seen that. But let me just do this
for all of you out there. That's why I'm an opinion writer and not a journalist.
Not breaking news. We love having Cliff Schechter every week, ladies and gentlemen.
Cliffy,
thank you so much for your. Your time today, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon, and I'll ping
we'll
you after the
we'll
show.
We'll figure out the future. Yeah, and I will be back soon, folks, to not break news again.
Okay, I'll ping you after the show.
Great job. Take it easy.
Bye. Cliff Schechter, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, each week, not each week, but almost every week, Jimmy Reefer Cake is... very reliably and with great aplomb sends us a song of the week. Has he done so this week?
Yeah, it's on and the back of your list.
It is on my list?
On the second page.
Oh, on the second page of the list. Oh my God, we got some Scott Brown sound. Two things
Dude.
Have converged.
Dude.
Two things have converged. I got two words for you. No, I got four words for you. Scott Brown, Chris Christie. Okay, the name of the song, is Gay Haters by Jimmy Reefer Cake. Let's listen to that now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Matthew Film Guy.
Gay haters wake up from their nightmare. They hate the gays, yet their own gayness is their biggest scare. I say open up the Bible and please show me the page that can justify this sick self-hating rage. Why do they twist the words in such a hateful way? There's actually nothing wrong with being gay, unless you're a gay, gay hater. Hatred of the gays causes such pain and strife. Some gay teens have even taken their own life. The gay haters who hate the gays the most really hate themselves. Having so much hatred must make life a living hell. Imagine the gay haters in the darkest pits of hell. Their home is now forever a fiery inferno. A Satan found a punishment to suit the gay haters well. An eternity of watching explicitly gay porno. They're genetics spliced with even more gay hormones. They're all a bunch of gay, gay haters. Gay haters can be Muslims. Gay haters can be Jews. Some Christians are particularly good at hating too. Is all this hate a sign of a decline in mental health? Because to truly love your fellow man, you must first love yourself. Don't be a gay hater.
No. Jimmy Reed for cake. All right. Well done, Jimmy. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone is a man who not only is so knowledgeable about film that he's literally referred to as film guy. He's also the man whose knowledge of film inspired this theme song. I'd never heard that last little sort of Doppler effect of film guy. Matthew, film guy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here, as always.
And now, Matthew, you're not in studio today. Did we ever get an update on how your air sold? Was it the last time you were in here? No. Was it two times ago?
It was the last time I was there, and it is very... interesting that you ask, because
let me just remind people what you did. I mean, you came in with a bunch of plastic bags. I don't know if they were new or old.
Yeah, brand new, high quality Ziploc zipper bags.
And you captured air from the Majority Report studio.
Authentic Majority Report studio air.
And in one instance, I actually blew into the bag. So it wasn't just the air here, but it was actually my own exhalation. In a bag. Then you put tags on them and sold them on eBay.
Yeah, and you signed them.
I signed them.
Actually, and here's the great news for everybody who's listening right now. Four of them sold. Mm. I did three more, which I held in reserve. And as of right now, they are available. This is totally impromptu.
Right.
They are available online. At my Twitter, at my eBay account, which is Langdon Boom, as I'm a seller there, and they all have a half hour remaining on them. So get them while they last. Only three more bags of authentic Majority Report podcast studio air captured on May the 13th of this year.
Now, what part of it was impromptu?
Just me saying the word impromptu.
Okay. Fair enough.
But doing it was completely and totally planned.
I
and
see.
And so was...
How much did you sell the other bags for? How much did you sell the other bags for?
Oh, at least $2 or $3, I think.
Wow, that's a huge markup on those plastic bags.
It is. I think I made about a 400% profit. So things are going swimmingly. But you know what? This is not for me to get rich. This is just for me to enrich the lives of viewers and loyal listeners and people who are right now online checking my eBay account.
In all honesty, do you think you have a problem?
Yes. Yes, I do. And
I mean, like, you're just addicted to selling this stuff.
Yeah. You know what? It's just part of the new economy, Sam. The new media, the new economy. You get to know the people that you interact with. It's not such a long distance between audience and people on the air.
What are you talking about? I'm talking about your eBay. Last time you were here, Mary was here, and she said, you have a problem.
Yeah.
You have a problem.
Yeah,
you're constantly looking for things to sell on eBay.
I'm granting that I have a problem, but the real problem is that the media today...
Do you have anything left in your house?
People like... Huh?
Do you have anything left in your apartment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the stuff, all the extra reserve stuff for emergencies. Yeah, definitely. But, you know, that's just, it's a way of clearing out the clutter, Sam. But that's a side point. You're confusing the issue. The issue with these bags is that, yes, it enables me to post things on eBay and have
he
people buy them, and I send them to them in the air. But really what this is about is giving back and connecting on a personal level, giving the chance for all of your listeners and all the fans of the Matthew Film Guy segment in particular a chance to own a piece of the Majority Report.
Now, did you ever you had threatened to do a Omaha, like when I should remind people that you did a Majority Report a Just Coffee promo with, yeah. Who did you do that with? Ted Alexandro. And you guys, yeah, did a commercial in your gym, which, yeah, I'm surprised it didn't get you kicked out. But then you were telling me that you were going to go and take do the same thing with the Omaha Steaks, that you were going to bring, like,
yeah,
raw meat into your gym. And
I mentioned that it might have been a little bit more difficult, unsanitary, and perhaps against the health code for me to do an equally humorous workout video with 10 pounds of Omaha Steaks. Also probably more expensive, so I probably will skip that. But then what did you say? You said you wanted me to do a Me Undies commercial in a similar vein. Mm. And I said, perhaps I could do a combo.
Was that late at night? Because that sounds like I might have been like a couple of Ambien into that.
Yeah. Speaking of late at night, do you remember what you wrote me last night?
Yeah, you're going to do the documentary, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. You wanted me to do something extremely, extremely intense. And I don't know if I could. I don't know if I could do that. Wait, I'm looking for it.
Well, I don't think I want to hear it now. No.
You don't want to hear it now?
No. We'll pass on that.
How much did you have to drink last night when you were writing me that?
Well, it was probably significant. late night last night.
It was extremely creative and extremely inspirational.
Oh, okay.
But maybe we'll just have to let that lie in the viewer's mind.
I don't want to know what it is. I certainly don't know. We'll talk about it later. So okay, what else have you been doing, Matthew?
Here it is. You said, why not record our conversation before you get on air as a micro behind-the-scenes audio documentary? You can interview Ted and Mary about your expectations, fears, aspirations, set the stakes. You get the call. We exchange politeness. Or you said politries, and maybe I say something that rocks your world or changes the way you look at yourself or opens up your entire perspective how you do what you do. And then I say, are you ready? We're on in 20 seconds. Cue Rocky music, and you metaphorically walk out from the shows in the stadium and into the white light, which engulfs you and absorbs all sound, scream and sound, go white. Okay.
Right.
Do you ever recall writing that?
Yeah, of course. I thought that you would enjoy that. I thought that was funny.
I did enjoy that. Immensely.
I actually thought that you were going to be shooting the documentary. That's why I was very curt with you on the phone.
Oh, God. Well, maybe I will. That's inspiring.
Why wouldn't you do that? That would have been a very funny short, buddy.
It would have been. It would have been a lot more effort and work that I would
do. But now you've basically tipped it all to the audience.
That's fine. That's the only way it's going to have to live. It's kind of like, the Jerry Lewis movie,
yeah,
The Day the
Clown. That's the thing.
I hate
writing for things that are not going to be executed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, you took a chance. You got burned, sorry to say.
I thought that was a funny documentary, that would have been.
It was. It was great. And let's just leave it the way it is.
I guess you don't have the chops to execute something.
A little
like
anticlimactic there, buddy.
It's not chops. It's not chops at all. It's just the desire and the inclination.
No. Oh, well,
but,
excuse
I'm
me.
I'm doing other stuff for you.
Apparently, you must be doing all sorts of other things.
Oh yeah, definitely I am.
I can be
well,
doing
why don't
cool
you tell
things.
Why don't you tell us what they are?
Nah, I don't think so.
You're not gonna give us an update on anything. What's the most interesting?
You know what I wanted to tell you? Do you know that I had a personal encounter with Muhammad Ali when I was a child?
No,
I didn't get to really talk to you guys since he passed away. But on a serious note, when I was 10 years old, I was at a doctor's office in downtown Akron, Ohio, and the nurse at the front desk, as my mother and I were leaving, said, oh, did you hear Muhammad Ali visiting a sick child at the hospital across the street? So we were, like, excited. We went over to look, and outside the hospital was a huge throng of people and fans waiting for him to come out, and we couldn't really get close. It was a big crowd, and eventually he did walk out with his entourage very solemnly and just went right to his limo, which actually we were standing by. And we just saw him, and I thought that was cool. But my mom, who kind of came up in the 60s, where she was kind of like a groupie, and she would run to hotel rooms to try to catch the Beatles coming out and all this kind of stuff with her friends. Mm-hmm. She overheard the limo driver say to one of the entourage, oh, what are we doing? We're going to the post office? Oh, okay. So she's like, I know what post office they must be going to. Let's go. So we ran back to the car, hightailed it over to the nearby post office in downtown Akron, and when we get there, there's his limo sitting all by itself anonymously in the parking lot. So she grabs her college notebook that she had and a pen, and I go up to the door of the limo, and I knock on the door, and the window goes down like very dramatically, and there it is, Muhammad Ali. He's sitting right there, and he's just like beaming, and he looks at me, and I said, can I get your autograph, champ? I mean, I'm 10 years old. I'm nervous as hell. And his Parkinson's had just sort of started to affect his speech. Mm. So he was able to say to me, what's your name, kid? And I said, it's Matthew, champ. And he takes the notebook, and he writes to Matthew, puts the date, and signs Muhammad Ali. And I'm like, wow, thanks. And I go to grab it, and he gives me, like, the silent, like, no, wait. And I was like, what? And he just writes Muhammad Ali, Muhammad Ali, Muhammad Ali, three more times on the page, flips it over, Muhammad Ali, Muhammad Ali, like four times on the next page. I'm like stunned. He flips it long ways, turns it, and writes across the whole next page his name, Muhammad Ali, flips it again, Muhammad Ali, like three times on the whole entire notebook. He fills it up and hands it back to me, and I'm completely, completely floored. And it's just one of the most memorable experiences of my life, meeting this guy, because here was a guy who was affected by his Parkinson's. He couldn't talk. He couldn't be verbal or brash the way he sort of always was. And yet he found a way to express his gregariousness, his generousness, his overall, just the spirit inside him to a kid that he had no sort of expectation of being sort of connected to. And just was as generous and as giving as he possibly could be. And it just blew me away. I mean, you know, he communicated just with his name so many times, that same kind of feeling that he used to have with his kind of his poems and his, you know, his what he became famous for. So anyway, I have that framed on my wall, and I actually sent it out to be reframed a week before he died. And wow. It was at the framers while he died. So I don't know if that's partly my fault or what, but anyway.
That's weird. That's a weird thing.
Weird.
Well, that's a great story, Matthew.
It's one of the coolest things that ever happened to me in my life.
So let me ask you this. Two questions. One,
How
did your mom know what post office he was going to? And two,
she's just that good. Yeah.
I want to hear about more about the groupie thing. Because, I mean, if a groupie's that good and shows up at the Beatles hotel, I have a feeling there's a lot more stories that are being left on the table here that maybe we should hear about.
You know what? They are probably so left on the table that they haven't even made their way to me yet. So maybe in a few more years, I'll find out exactly what went on in those
hotels. Matthew, you're old enough now where you can say to your mom, like, you can tell me, Ma.
Mom, did you do Paul McCartney?
No, honestly.
She would tell me that. She would tell me that. She, you know, when the Beatles were first here, she and her friend were waited outside. You know, it was not so intimate as being in the room with them. But, you know, my mom got into other things. Like, she had a cousin that got her into Liza Minnelli and Judy Garland's hotel room one time. She hung out with them. She, you know, when she was in college.
Did she tell you about what happened there?
Just that they hung out. And actually, Judy Garland made a remark on my mother's shoes, and she was wearing red shoes. And she said, oh, those look familiar.
And then my shoes fell off.
And she hates that. So it always comes back to Sam and shoes, doesn't it? Shoes and glasses.
So wait a second.
She got hit on by the drummer of Three Dog Night. Oh, you know, these are great family.
How did
stories,
she respond to that?
My dad was with her at the time. They were dating, and my dad said he was okay with it as long as they would get like backstage passes or free tickets to the show. The hitting on, not the consummating of the hit.
I see. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is it possible you just got like the PG version of that story or what?
It's very possible.
And then Judy Garland stole my glasses.
I'm actually curious to hear if Bernie or Bust Bill Clinton has had any groupie experiences that you can share.
Come on. Now, wait a second. Don't get off the hook here.
I do have a movie recommendation, though.
I'm sorry. I'm just a huge fan.
I do have a movie recommendation. If you want to understand what's going on with my wife, I would recommend the 70s classics Parallax View. And earlier than that, the Manchurian Candidate. Except she didn't need to be brainwashed.
But what about, there's
she
an obvious one.
She didn't need to be brainwashed.
There's an obvious.
Because she herself is a horrible, cruel bitch that makes Macbeth look like Mother Teresa. Hashtag Bernie or Buzz.
All right. Okay,
release
cool.
the transcripts.
But
that
is
makes
it,
perfect sense.
Isn't the obvious choice for Bernie or bust Bill Clinton would be the
Eddie Murphy
Citizen
Raw.
United Hillary, the movie.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a little tacky, but they got all the basic points right.
So,
yeah.
All right, so
I
Matthew,
actually haven't seen that, so I can't say.
Now, Matthew, what else have you been doing? You've been doing some corporate videos. You've been obviously too busy to make a fully written and realized faux documentary that would have been a huge hit online.
I know.
Viral.
Shame. I haven't been able to do that. I've been involved in a lot of things.
And I should also say, just coincidentally, that white light at the end of the documentary that I recommended to you, same one from the Parallax View.
Yes, okay. I knew I'd recognize that from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And, well, that's also, you'll recall, that we also use that in A Bad Situationist.
When
Arthur gets to the top of the stairs, I wanted that to be, that was the homage to the Parallax View.
Uh-huh, I remember it very well. I remember the sight of your slow-motion giant calves running up that stairwell.
That's right. Yeah, you know what I love about that exchange? That no one else knows what we're talking about. literally tens of thousands of people, and only you and I know what we're talking about.
Guys, the idea of Nelson Mandela's a neo-fascist makes more sense in this conversation.
Exactly. I was going to say, we should just clip that part of us talking about my calves and that white light for
it.
YouTube.
Yeah.
And that... And just supplant the whole show and just include that.
You know, there's got to be a supercut out there somewhere of all the white light going into the white light kind of moments in movies. And we'll just find that and we'll just insert yours in there because I'm sure nobody else knows about that.
That's true. So what else have you been doing?
Well, Sam, I've totally renovated my office space. It is complete and upgraded into a level which will
can,
now...
Can you post pictures?
Yeah, actually, I can post some pictures. All we can right. post pictures, right, baby? Okay, we'll post some pictures. I caulked a new vanity in the bathroom.
Did you refer to me
bathroom.
As baby?
Did you just Barry
oh,
White,
sorry,
Sam?
Sorry, sweetie. Sorry, sweetie. Honey, baby.
Do you
we
have Mary,
Dudley.
Honey, baby?
We got Dudley.
Does what? Mary sit with you when you do these interviews? Like, does she sit down next to you, like, as moral?
No, she doesn't.
You know, she's probably just there to make sure that you don't try and, like, sell, I don't know, the kitchen table on eBay.
Uh-huh. Everything's going well.
Cough twice if she's right next to you and you can't say All right. Well, Matthew Film Guy.
Yes?
What?
But wait, Sam, I forgot to tell you about our beautiful new puppy, Dudley. He's working out so well. He's working out so well. He's the best thing that ever happened to our lives.
Really?
I urge everyone to get a puppy.
No. Sam doesn't like puppies. I'd love to hear about Dudley.
I don't like
Dudley
puppies.
Is such a great... He's learning so well. He comes, he sits, he stays. He poops on the pad about 75% of the time. It's getting really good.
How old?
He's so cute. 11 weeks.
Now,
oh my God. It's like a prodigy. What's happening?
He is. He's getting into Puppy Harvard. We got all the best tutors for him. He's going to puppy kindergarten.
What kind of
he's
puppy?
He's definitely going to... Havanese.
Now, when you talk about puppies, are you talking about the whole the movement to undercut the Hugos because of the lack of integrity in the fantasy sci-fi awards sector?
No, is there something wrong with the Hugo Awards that are being undercut by puppies?
There is a Gamergate analog to to the Hugo Awards that's going on, where some right-wing sci-fi fans and writers don't like the fact that the Hugos are awarding people who are writing about science fiction and fantasy that is more inclusive.
That's
it is
horrifying.
So gay.
I'm pretty sure Dudley is against that.
Yeah. Okay.
Although that reminds me, somebody actually recommended that show, The Expanse, on the show a couple shows ago this week.
Who did that?
And that is a caller. But I you kind of scoff at it that it's like a middle class in space, but it is an extremely interesting look at how economic strata kind of follows us into the future. And there's a really interesting dichotomy between the people who live on Mars, who are kind of self-made, the people who live on Earth, who are sort of now like the elite. And the
now, what station
and the
is that on?
Who live in the asteroid belt, who are the working class.
What station
Sci-fi
is that?
Channel.
Sci-Fi Channel. Well, and you know, I'll give it a try.
Season's already over, so you can catch up.
Oh, good. I like that. I always like that. Yeah. That was my favorite thing about Battlestar Galactica, which was that I didn't watch it until like a year or two after it was over. Maybe more, and so I could just like blow through the whole thing. Didn't have to wait for it to catch
it. Maybe want to wait another year or two because they're only the first season's out, but it's really good. It's got kind of like a film noir kind of element to it. It's like one of the main characters that you follow is sort of a down on his luck, sort of a low class bum of a detective who sort of stumbles onto a intergalactic conspiracy, you know, Chinatown. But it's actually. The world that it builds is really remarkable, and for that reason alone, I think you'd be hooked by it. But anyway, that's just a side point. Back to Dudley. He's so cute.
Okay. Now, so what is the film that you have to recommend for us this week, Matthew?
Huh? Well,
film
I'm sorry,
guy.
I was looking at Dudley. What did you say?
Matthew, film guy.
Oh, right. Film guy. Yes. So today's film that I would like to suggest the audience investigate is actually an extremely... upbeat and family-friendly film about.
Let me ask you this: how do you propose they investigate it? Would they maybe watch it?
You know, start by looking it up online, then commence downloading, and then
downloading.
If you then watch it,
FBI monitors the show. All right, yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. Continue.
Yeah. In all seriousness, this is something that you'll want to watch because it has the name of your son in it, and it is called Son of Saul.
Son of Saul.
Now, not to turn on a dime too much, but it is a Holocaust film.
Oh, great.
And it is just when you thought that they couldn't beat that dead horse enough times with the sort of the heartstring pulling and the easy drama of such a horrific chapter in human existence, this film, with its extremely dedicated and I think just groundbreaking visual of language and extremely rigorous visual language, takes it to another level. It's basically like you are there, because without giving too much away, it follows this man named Saul as he is actually a Hungarian Jew who was in Auschwitz. And he's a member of, I don't know if you know what was called the Sommerkommando. They were like the Jews that were put in charge of like cleaning the ovens and moving the bodies. They were sort of the slave labor force that did all the dirty work for the Nazis. And the film basically stays on his face, like a 4 foot away medium shot for the entire film. There's very few reaction shots. There's very few kind of POV shots. You're basically on him. And you're looking at him and hearing things coming in and out of the frame, and there are a lot of very long takes. So it really immerses you in not just the character, because you're with him so intimately, but the place. It's got that thing where like it suggests more things outside the frame. Like you hear gunshots going off, you see sort of glimpses of bodies being moved. It's not exactly, I wouldn't call it explicit, like a lot of gore or violence, but it is extremely disturbing because of obviously what it depicts, the mass murder of hundreds of thousands of people. And it's kind of got a somewhat of a MacGuffin of a story, what he's trying to do, but it's extremely moving, it's extremely powerful. And like I said, a sort of a jaded Jew like myself who's been watching Holocaust film since I was 12 years old in Hebrew school and watching bodies being thrown in pits and, you know, having all that sort of thrown on you, it had the effect of really shaking me out of that complacency and reminding you of just how dehumanizing that whole situation was, and also how it could happen, because it really gets into the interconnected sort of social strata of who was in charge of who or how they reacted to each other and which Jews turned on each other, which Jews were resisting. And I just think it's a really important film. And it's the first film by this Hungarian filmmaker named Laszlo Nims. And it won the Cannes Film Festival last year, and it's just coming to America now. And I say if you're really feeling bad about yourself, check that out, and you'll realize that it could be a lot worse.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what's something I want to watch with the kids.
Yeah, especially Saul, Son of Saul. Mm. Watch it with Saul. Actually, you know, how old is Mila now? She's about 11, right? 10?
Almost 11, yep.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but when I was in the sixth grade, I started watching, you know, in Hebrew school, actual Holocaust films. Like, we watched Night and Fog, the Alan Menes documentary.
Yep.
And it was just, you know, you were just old enough to kind of not just completely laugh at it, like to really be affected by it. So
I think I'm willing to wait another couple of years. I'm not sure that was such a...
I'll tell you how it happens again. You elect my wife. That's how it happens.
Let me back up, Sam. Are you suggesting that I may have been somehow negatively affected by being exposed to this?
No, I'm saying that I was. I feel like we started watching it in second grade. I mean, I really it was just too.
Well, it was still happening when you were in second grade, right?
You know, frankly, the time when I was in second grade, the distance between that time and the end of the war. Was less than, it would be certainly less than the time between now and when I was in second grade. I mean, it was significantly less.
Yep.
So, all right.
Yep.
Well,
between now and Woodstock anyway.
Well, I was not at Woodstock, just FYI.
I know.
So Son of Saul and The Expanse.
Yeah, definitely check out The Expanse. That's some entertaining and with a sort of a cryptic social message sci-fi.
All right. Well, and that's exciting.
Not so cryptic, but extremely searing, soul-searing stuff.
All right, and just tell us one more time, because I know that's why we land you every once a month, what your eBay handle is.
Langdon Boom.
Langdon Boom.
Yeah, you can also go to my Twitter, which is at Langdon Boom, and there's a link in my, about me, my little bio there, and you can find your way to get.
How many things have you sold on eBay? Does it give you a running tally?
Well, I can, I can't, because some people are not very nice and they don't leave feedback, but the feedbacks I've gotten, 794. But I got to say, there's probably at least another 100 over the 15 years I've been doing this that didn't write back. So
wow, 900 things you've
sold.
There's
4 minutes left on airbags number 3, 4, and 5. So act now.
Get them while they're still semi-moist, I guess, right?
Yeah. And they're still semi-inflated, yeah.
Film Guy Matthew, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Same here, Sam. Take care.
Okay. You know, you hand a guy a pot of gold in the form of a fully formed, not just concept, but basically script for a fake documentary, like a 2-minute movie, where it would lead up to that one moment where he's on the phone, like the behind the scenes. What's it like? I know a lot of people have asked me, like, what do you say to your guests right before they come on? And Matthew could have both exposed that and shown how much that means to him on not just a daily basis, but a weekly basis or any type of basis.
I mean, tell me about it. The electorate had Bernie Sanders. They chose my wife.
It's just
the worst.
You give, you give, you give, and people spit it back in your face.
I don't know if he quite spit it back in your face. You might want to rein it in a little bit.
I
think he sort of gently, like, kind of almost like a baby, sort of not spit, but maybe sort of gently
dribbled it back out in my face.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it was quite as sort of hostile.
Babies don't have the capacity to spit, really. It's funny to try and watch Saul spitting. He can't spit, but he can, like...
Is he still like in a...
Yeah. Folks, speaking of spitting, Scott Brown, Chris Christie, we got that sound coming up. We have more. Pat Robertson, he's still a horrible human being. One of those guys who's not mellowed with age. Good for him. Cornel West delivering a Palestinian rights statement at the in the platform fight. We'll get that. And, of course, John McCain. Country first. The adult in the room. Basically quoting Alex Jones. All that and more on the fun half of today's program. Folks, you can join us there every day by becoming a member to The Majority Report. Simply go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up. It's easy. Pennies a day. Support the show. Keep it thriving. Keep it growing. Yeah, the fact is, you know, we did not, you know, for some reason, we alienated people during this election season a little bit. Some people. Not all people, but some people. And so, you know, that's fine.
By being honest.
Yeah.
Being just giving it our best take and right. Not playing to anybody's sensibilities.
Yes.
And distorting our honest view of things.
I that's the way I would characterize it. So if you appreciate this show and listen on a semi-regular basis, why not become a member? I mean, you're paying probably more for that service online that you don't even use, or you're paying God knows how much for the cable service or that other thing. Forget that other thing. Do this thing. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. If you don't want to buy it from Amazon, buy it from Jet.com. At our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. You click on those links, you bookmark them, you do your Amazon buying through there, or you do your Jet.com buying through there, we get a kickback. Hence, MajorityReportKickback.com. Going to take a quick break, then head into the fun half. Folks, for you freebies, have a nice weekend. To you members, the party starts now.